There is no question in my mind that if the legislature creates a separate marijuana control board and a separate marijuana control agency, they will not meet those deadlines.
Considering the timeline to implement the new marijuana law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, if a road to Ambler gets built, how will it affect caribou migration?
If they were going to extend that road from Ambler out to any deep water port, then it would bisect Western Arctic Herd Range, and caribou would have to cross that road multiple times per year.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
The State Highway Safety Office says traffic fatalities climbed in 2014. 65 people died in wrecks last year, more than the previous 6 years. Counting pedestrians and cyclists, 70 people died in 2014. Highway Safety Office research analyst Miles Brooks says it's too early to say precisely how many fatal wrecks involve drivers impaired by alcohol or drugs. Brooks says so far about 38% have been confirmed to have involved drivers with blood alcohol levels over the legal limit. After considering a delay in legal marijuana sales, Governor Bill Walker has confirmed that implementation of rules regulating the drug should meet the schedule approved by voters. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
At a Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce event in mid-December, Governor Bill Walker made a crack about how he wished he could delay the work of marijuana regulation for 4 years until the end of his term. During campaign season, back when he was still a candidate and the fate of a marijuana ballot measure was yet to be decided, Walker spent little time talking about the initiative except to say he opposed it. Now, obligated by voters to do something about it, Walker told the Fairbanks audience he would like to delay some parts of the marijuana initiative by 90 days. But in a press release on Tuesday, the governor announced he plans to stick to the schedule set by the initiative, with marijuana business licenses available by May of 2016. According to those tasked with the work of implementation, making that deadline is still going to be tight.
There's very little leeway or room in that timeline.
That's Cynthia Franklin. She directs the state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which is working with the Department of Revenue and the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to come up with an implementation plan. At a recent meeting with the governor, participants concluded that it is possible to meet the terms of the initiative. It's just not guaranteed.
When you actually go look at the process for meeting those deadlines, really everything has to go right. What we were pleased when we had the meeting with the governor's office is that everyone is on board with making everything go as right as possible.
The marijuana initiative gets added to the books on February 24th, and the law will basically go into effect in stages. Possession of the drug outside the home will become legal at that point. But the state legislature will be given the chance to set some of the terms governing commercial operations before any sales can legally happen. Then a regulatory board has until November 24th to craft its own rules for the industry. It won't be until next February until marijuana ventures can submit licensing applications, and a few months after that before they can get off the ground. While that sounds like a long time, Franklin says there are plenty of opportunities for holdups, and a lot of that depends on what the legislature decides to do with the new marijuana policy. Lawmakers could just let the existing Alcoholic Beverage Control Board manage the cannabis industry, but they could also create a separate marijuana control board to govern it. Initiative proponents have supported this idea to prevent regulatory power struggles between the alcohol and marijuana industries, and a bill to create such a board is already being drafted by Senate Judiciary Chair Liesl McGuire. Franklin says if the legislature goes that route and serves it with a new agency, it will be impossible to meet the initiative's deadlines.
There is no question in my mind that if the legislature creates a separate marijuana control board and a separate marijuana control agency, and that agency has to be hired and put in place and put somewhere physical, and, you know, they all have to learn and understand their new jobs, they will not meet those deadlines.
I don't know that it would be impossible, but certainly it would take up valuable time.
Bruce Schulte represents a marijuana industry trade group called the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. He says this trade-off leaves its members in a bit of a bind. Schulte says they like the idea of marijuana and alcohol being regulated separately, but they also want to see implementation happen as quickly as possible. Constitutionally, the legislature cannot weaken or undo an initiative for 2 years. But because so much of those 2 years need to be spent on rulemaking before retailers can even sell the product, Schulte is worried that puts the new marijuana law in a vulnerable spot.
Optimistically, the first stores would be open by August, maybe September of 2016. So at that point, you've got barely 6 months to establish a track record and to generate some revenue and to prove that it can be done responsibly before the legislature then has the opportunity to shut the whole thing down.
Schulte thinks it's possible to create a separation between alcohol and marijuana regulators while still meeting the initiative timeline. He says that could be done by establishing an independent marijuana board while keeping it in the same agency as the ABC board and having it share the same staff. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Many Alaskans are keeping an eye on pot sale rules in other states in the wake of last year's legalization vote. The Washington State Liquor Control Board says that state's retail marijuana industry sold more than $63 million worth of marijuana in 2014. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports.
Sales of legal recreational marijuana in Washington state began July 8th. Limited supply quickly drove up the price of retail weed. Brian Smith is a spokesman for the Liquor Control Board.
What we're hearing today is that the market is flush with marijuana and prices dropped so low that many of the producers and processors are concerned about the price.
The industry has brought in more than $15 million in tax revenue for the state, according to the agency. In Washington, pot's taxed at 25% at each level of sale, from grower to processor, then from processor to retailer, and finally from retailer to the customer, who also pays sales tax. The latest forecast shows Washington's retail marijuana industry is projected to bring in nearly $700 million in revenue for the state by 2019.
I'm Conrad Wilson in Vancouver, Washington.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, climate change and the annual Christmas bird count.
Of course, the big question was, you know, these were doves that were not native. Could they survive the winter?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. And by the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
The attorney for a Homer man suspected of harassing an intoxicated, unconscious teenager at a 2012 party says his client will plead guilty to felony evidence tampering and hindering prosecution charges. Defense attorney Philip Widener says 22-year-old Anthony Restoritis also will plead guilty to misdemeanor harassment and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. A Kenai grand jury indicted Restoritis and his brother in September 2013 on felony charges of sexual assault. A judge in August dismissed the charges, citing problems with information presented to the grand jury. New charges filed Tuesday say Anthony Restoritis deleted photos of the incident and encouraged others to do so. Fishermen taking part in the state waters black cod fishery in Prince William Sound will likely be facing lower harvest limits when the fishery opens next spring. From Valdez, KCHU's Marsha Lynn has more.
On December 19th, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued a notice that registration for the fishery's 59 permit holders is due by April 1st, or they'll be closed out of the new season, which starts on April 15th, 2015. The department's recent news release also warns that quotas will be down, adding that the 2014 harvest of just under 97,000 pounds of sablefish, also known as black cod, was the lowest harvest on record.
It's true, and it's been a trend in recent years that we've been watching as the harvest goes down and the catch per unit effort has been going down as well. You know, the department needs to address this trend. Our guideline harvest level has stayed the same since 1993 at 242,000 pounds.
Maria Wessel, Fish and Game Assistant Area Manager for Prince William Sound Groundfish and Shellfish, says that's based on what she calls a yield per habitat model.
In other words, how many fish would be living in the habitat that's available in the sound. We don't have a fishery independent survey to assess biomass, and so our main information is coming from the fishery itself, and it certainly looks like we need to adjust our guideline harvest level, and we don't have a way currently to do that.
She hopes a project started in 2011 to determine how sablefish populations in the sound are mixed with those in the Gulf of Alaska will be useful.
It's certainly looking like those populations are well mixed, and we're hopeful to come up with a method to adjust our guideline harvest level based on the total allowable catch that NIMS determines for the Gulf of Alaska.
Fishermen won't know their harvest quotas until close to opening day.
So we have the registration deadline of April 1st. The fishery opens on April 15th. So, you know, we know for sure that it will be set before April 15th. Our registration deadline enables us to assign the quota shares to the individual permit holders. And so we typically announce what the individual quota shares are that first week of April after we get all of the registrations in. And so I think we'll be looking at the first week of April before we have any kind of official number.
Harvesters are mainly small boat fishermen from Cordova, says Wessel.
I'd say it's, you know, the 50 and below and a couple of 35 and below that are fishing now.
And she anticipates the fleet will support Fish and Game's approach to adjusting the catch quotas.
I think most of the folks that participate in the fishery are aware that there's a change coming in that guideline harvest level. They know what's going on, and I think most of them will welcome that change because they want to see the resource protected. But we wanted to be sure that everybody had a heads up that you know, we're trying to deal with this and that there is a change coming.
Registrations and log sheets are available at Fish and Game offices in Cordova, Kodiak, Homer, and Anchorage, and by appointment with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers in Seward and Valdez, where there are no Fish and Game offices. Wessel says folks can also send registration materials to the Cordova office via fax or email. In Valdez, I'm Marsha Lynn.
Delta Junction area birders participating in the annual Christmas bird count spotted a rare species not normally seen this far north in the winter. The birders say that's probably partly because of this year's mild winter, and as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, some also suspect the cumulative effects of climate change.
Steve Dubois and other birders in the Delta Junction area are all aflutter that two of the four Eurasian collared doves that have been hanging around the area since last summer were spotted again in last week's bird count.
So we were anxious to see if these doves would still be present for the Christmas bird count, and sure enough, they were.
That's significant, especially this late into winter, says Gail Mayo. She heads up Fairbanks's Arctic Audubon Society chapter.
Oh, yeah, it would be noteworthy, and it would definitely be a first for the Delta count. It would definitely be a first if we were to see one in Fairbanks.
Du Bois is a retired State Fish and Game Department wildlife biologist who coordinates the Delta area bird count. He says even a summer sighting would be unusual for a bird species that was first spotted in the Western Hemisphere less than four decades ago.
They got into the Bahamas and then into the United States back in the 1970s and have been expanding their range north and west since then.
Du Bois says the doves were first spotted in Alaska around Ketchikan in the summer of 2006. He says there were a few sightings around the interior in recent years before four showed up at a bird feeder in Delta last summer and took up residence.
Of course, the big question was, you know, these were doves that were not native. Could they survive the winter?
Du Bois suspects they probably wouldn't have lived this long in a typical winter, and that if it ever really gets cold this winter, they probably wouldn't make it.
My guess is that they probably will not establish themselves year-round through the winter.
Du Bois says he believes the appearance of the Eurasian collared dove this time of year is part of a trend of bird species ranging farther north as the Earth's climate continues to warm. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or AIDA, says it's still moving forward to prepare an environmental impact statement for the contentious Ambler Road, even after Governor Walker has placed a hold on the project. The Ambler Road would branch west off the Dalton Highway near Evansville and run into the copper deposit near Ambler. If the road eventually does get the go-ahead, it'll be a mixed bag for the Northwest Arctic caribou herd, who winter on and migrate through land that the road would bisect. Jim Dow is a fish and game biologist based in Kotzebue.
I think we've got enough information to show that with regard to caribou, it's not an easy answer. It varies tremendously. It's hard to make categorical statements saying, you know, roads are terrible for caribou or they have no effect. It's not that simple.
Dow says most of the caribou's southerly fall migration would place them just to the west of where the road would end. However, he says sometimes instead of traveling south toward the Seward Peninsula, they hook a left and walk up the Kobuk.
You know, I've seen 50 or 80,000 caribou walk completely out of the Kobuk and into the Koyukuk, the upper Koyukuk drainage. And that's completely along that road, that proposed road.
AIDA has said many times that the Ambler Road will be the only road, that it'll be closed and remediated once mining operations have ceased. The public has been skeptical, especially given its cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Dow says he doesn't support or oppose the road, but if this is just the beginning of development, he says he's taking the long-term view.
If they were going to extend that road from Ambler out to any deep water port, then it would bisect Western Arctic Herd Range and caribou would have to cross that road multiple times per year. That would be a very, very different animal. So I tend to think about long-term things, not just the next 10 years or 20 years. What's this road going to look like in 50, 75 years or 100 years? Those are sort of the time frames you need to think about.
And while AIDA has maintained that the Ambler Road would be industrial use only, Dow says the public, including subsistence users and villagers near the road, would likely desire access for hunting and other uses if the road were built.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Subsistence is important to many rural Alaskans. Please consider applying for a three-year term on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Apply by January 23, 2015. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is an archived edition of AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Puppet Town. Haines seems like a quintessential Southeast Alaska town. There are eagles, bears, salmon, big mountains, and rough water. It's a picture book, no stoplight, no movie theater, low crime type of community. But there's a seedier and eclectic side of Haines that emerged late last winter, the underground puppet scene. From member station KHNS in Haines, Margaret Friedenauer has the story.
We aren't talking about Muppets.
Those fuzzy, funny, and googly-eyed characters are not the same as puppets, not in Haines, Alaska. Here, there are at least three puppet troupes, dozens of self-taught puppeteers and puppet makers, and one artist who has traveled to Europe to explore the history of puppetry, Bernd Power.
And what I saw is I saw a puppet troupe who was doing things with, I don't know, it looked like stuff from their backyards, kind of things you'd find at the Salvation Army, rusting metal, old toys and such. And I said, we could do that.
That's Power at the Sheldon Museum in Haines, where he helped curate the puppet exhibit Strung Up and Reconfigured. Power is sort of the father of puppetry in Haines. Almost 10 years ago, he gathered a group of artists and formed a puppet troupe. Here's artist Debbie Knight Kennedy explaining how she fell into the puppet scene.
Burns came up to me one day before I knew him very well, and he said, so, you're a doll maker. So, you can make your dolls talk. I'm starting a puppet troupe. That was it. It's just all over for me, you know?
After a few years, Power stayed with traditional puppetry, while some in the group wandered in a different direction. Now the group is called Geppetto's Junkyard and consists of more than a dozen people, including a plumber, a yogi, a boat builder, retired teacher, jiu-jitsu instructor, and others. This winter, they created a show called Space Lust. It was described on posters as a cross between steampunk, space cowboy, and puppet space opera. It was a wild scene of live music, special effects, acting, and, of course, puppets.
That's it, Joey. Blue moon, you left me standing alone.
The puppets are all handmade and usually assembled from found objects like bicycle parts, kitchen gadgets, vacuum hoses, and wood. Knight Kennedy's husband, Gene Kennedy, is also in the troupe. He is a handyman and plumber, but is drawn to creating puppets like the carved wooden horse he made with multiple moving parts.
This is why I like it. It's all wooden cutout plywood. Basically, there's four parts to the body, and there's two levers that work in tandem, and the head swings and on its own and is counterweighted with lead weight so that it always comes back to the same place.
Geppetto's Junkyard has their fans. They pack in the sporadic shows. But no one, especially the puppeteers and actors, pretend they are traditionalists. Power is more so. Back at the museum, he says he doesn't think anyone in Haines is true to traditional puppetry.
But there are some puppet styles, for instance, that are take real skill to manipulate. It's not as simple as you just stick your hand up and you move your wiggle it around. I mean, you learn very definite things about how to move your hand. And it takes months and months and months of training, years, really, to be good.
Of the more than 100 puppets in the exhibit, about two-thirds were made locally. There was even one that might be local from several generations ago. It's a bone, shell, and sinew Tlingit puppet on loan from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Power says he's drawn to puppets because they still surprise people. He says when he goes on the road with a show, he's not pigeonholed because puppets are still edgy and intriguing enough to cross all ages and interests.
Because if you have a music group, you say to someone, oh, what kind of music do you have? And they say, and you say, whatever your style of music is, and they say, you play there. But if you have a puppet troupe, the first question out of my mind when I would try to book, find some place to play is it for children? And I go, well, not particularly. And as soon as you say that, they're completely blank. Okay. And you can play for anybody.
And maybe that's why puppets and Haines go together. For puppeteers like Melina Shields with Geppetto's Junkyard, it makes perfect sense.
I think that there's just inherently something sort of creative that happens by taking these found objects and then letting the puppets be born into whoever they are. And it's just magic.
Reporting from the self-proclaimed puppet capital of Alaska, in Haines, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed to Kasan, located in southeast Alaska on Prince of Wales Island. The coastal native village is home to the oldest Haida building in the world.
Sinodung Haidung Gilagung Kiosgansi Hinodikyan. I'm Frederick Otilius Olson Jr. and I'm from Kasan. I'm a Eagle. I'm a Haida, Alaskan Haida. You'd see the greenest trees, you'd see a lot of water. You probably, if you couldn't see, you'd feel a lot of water falling on you in a surprising amount all day long, maybe for weeks. And clean air, friendly people. Kasan is kind of funny. You know, people of working age either work for the tribe, Organized Village of Kasan, or there's a few jobs with the city of Kasan. And some people work in, they might live in Kasan, but they work in another community or, you know, have seasonal work and whatnot. Oh, for fun and tradition, at the same time, one might walk out to Naiwan, the whale house, as it's known widely, the last traditional Haida building in the United States, currently being restored. It was never originally built or intended to be a community hall or anything. You know, it was Chief Sunny Hat's home, his wife and extended family like that. It's exciting. We're following in our ancestors' footsteps and in their footprint of the building. It was originally built where it is now in 1880. Kasan was one of the hardest hit by diseases of contact. That may have been one of the reasons that led Sunny Hat to build the house where he did, because of all the deaths. In our part of Southeast Alaska, you can have days where it's sort of in the 40s somewhere, kind of rainy. You could have that day any time of the year, even July, November, where a temperate rainforest would get well over 100 inches of rain a year. Just where I want to be, it's hard to explain.
Frederick Otilius Olson Jr. is from Kasan. His interview is from April 2014. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to this archived edition of AK. We had help from Margaret Friedenauer, Jolene Almendarez, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Conrad Wilson in Portland, Marsha Lynn in Valdez, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Jen Ruckel in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.